Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Once part of the ATA tribe, you'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Chad Criddle. Chad started his professional life with animals as a casual keeper at Taronga Zoo in Sydney, Australia in 2009. From here, Chad's love of telling the story of wildlife and animal training using positive reinforcement led him to work on animal shows in zoos in North Queensland, New South Wales, USA, and South Australia. Chad's time at his current role at Adelaide Zoo began in 2015 as a nature theatre presenter and as free flight coordinator in the team that worked on growing the Flying Colours Free Flight Bird Show. Since early 2019, Chad has been the senior keeper of birds and herpetofauna, working with one of the largest and most diverse bird collections in Australia. In this role, Chad is loving being involved in three breed for release to the wild programs and conservation programs for a multitude of species. Chad continues to fly the flag of positive reinforcement training to build husbandry behaviors within zoos and loves to spread the message to the wider community. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome my good friend, Chad Criddle, to the ATA Christmas special episode today. Chad is patiently waiting by. Chad, how is everything there in beautiful South Australia?
It is fantastic. We've had a beautiful, beautiful start to spring, and thank you so much for having me on the podcast, Brian. I really appreciate it. And hello to all the ATA people out there today.
Hey, an absolute pleasure. Thank you for making time to come and hang out with us at Animal Training Academy. And everyone listening, we had to start this introduction three times today because I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop laughing because I could see Chad's face there. It's not often, and potentially this is the first time I've had someone on the podcast show where I have employment relationship with them. So me and Chad used to work together years ago at Ken's Tropical Zoo in Australia. We had a ton of fun flying eagles and parrots and owls and everything in between. So it's great to reconnect with an old friend today and to bring someone who I deeply respect and who I know has a great knowledge and practical application of positive reinforcement onto the show. So
oh, thanks for that. I very much respect you too. It's going to be good fun catching up and talking training as we like to do.
It's going to be hard not to get sidetracked and forget that we're recording a podcast and get stuck in some nostalgia and old stories. But we'll try to stay focused. Hey, Chad, could you take everyone listening back to the start of your behavior odyssey where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training? Tell us about that time and some stories from some of the animals you worked with.
Well, for me, it started professionally and non-professionally with the free flight bird show at Taronga Zoo. I was living in Sydney. I grew up in Sydney. And I went to see the show, would have been in 97 or 98, I reckon. I was 7 or 8 years old. And we watched the show and it was pretty mind-blowing. But at the end of the show, at that time, there was a blue and gold macaw that would fly in from behind the trees somewhere and would fly down and land on the presenter's hand to finish the show. And as a 7 or 8 year old, this macaw looked like it flew out of nowhere, came down out of the sky, landed on this trainer's hand. And it just kind of blew my mind. I was hooked into that concept straight away. And then, so as a kid, I started keeping birds. So I had budgies and I had cockatiels, and I just started getting more involved in animals and really enjoyed that. I took a bit of a diversion in high school, and I ended up focusing on musical theatre and theatre for a number of years, and that was where I thought my career was going. But during my high school years, I volunteered at Taronga Zoo at a program called Youth at the Zoo, which at the time was like guiding and more working with visitors rather than animals. But through that process, you got to start spending time with keepers on the ground, and you started seeing these relationships between keepers and their animals, and also the effect that that could have on the visitors that were coming through the zoo. And so following on from that, I kind of decided when I was 16, 17 that I didn't want to stop working in zoos. It was just something I really loved. I was spending all my weekends, all my school holidays at the zoo. And so there was obviously a passion there. I finished volunteering and I went for a casual keeper role, which at Taronga at the time, I'm not sure what's going on there now with the system, but at the time you kind of would get on a list, so you weren't guaranteed a role on any particular department. But during that time, I met a keeper who worked at the bird show. I expressed interest. I said I'd always loved seeing the show. It was something I was very interested in learning more about. And a week later, I got my first shift at the Taronga Zoo free flight show. And from there, it just kind of snowballs. You just kind of, once you're in that environment and you're working with animals in a way where the animals are choosing to come towards you, they're choosing to interact with you, particularly in that free flight environment where there's really nothing stopping them just going, adios, I'm flying across Sydney Harbour. It's a pretty incredible thing to be a part of and to see. And I just couldn't get enough of it. And so, yeah, that was the start of it all. And from there, it's just taken me in lots of different directions, but it's been a fun journey so far and absolutely love it.
So we've had a number of people on the show that have worked at and still work at the Taronga Bird Show. We've had someone who you currently work with at Adelaide Zoo, Nicholas Bishop. Peter Clark's been on the show. We've had Erin Stone there. Erin Stone on the show, Erin Davidson.
Yeah.
And I've met quite a few of the people that have worked at the show and currently work there. And what sticks out to me is the calibre of person, the calibre of skill and the knowledge. And did you feel that, like, are you, when you're working at that show, do you feel kind of like the greatness that has come before you? And like, I mean, can you share some stories from that time and kind of what it was like to be involved in such a dynamic and knowledgeable and skilled team?
Yeah, I think in that environment, when you in some ways, I didn't know, I'll be honest, because I was so young and new to the whole thing. But at the time, I still loved it, and I was working with people who'd worked all around the world. Matthew Kettle, who's still the supervisor there, who's just a fountain of knowledge and has worked around birds for decades and has been at the Taronga show since it opened, is just an amazing place to start, let alone, you know, when I was there, we had Gray Fisher, who'd worked in the USA, who's still working there. Erin Stone was there at the time. And then you started slowly meeting people through that time who'd worked there in the past. So it was like Peter Clark, and then I kind of started learning more about Natural Encounters, Inc., so Steve Martin's company, because they consulted on setting up that show. And then it kind of started to sink in. Like, I was in a real hub of knowledge and learning. And when you're in that sort of environment and I was 18, 19, it's just an amazing place to learn. It's an amazing place to watch people who just know their work inside and out, but also who are committed to learning more and developing skill. And they were such generous teachers as well. And I was probably pretty annoying, I reckon, because I was so keen on it. And so despite not being rostered on, I'd come in on my days off, or I'd you know, if there wasn't a shift available for me for the following week because I was a casual, I'd still come in when I was free and I'd just spend the day there learning as much as I could, spending as much time with these trainers and their animals to soak in as much knowledge as I possibly could. And it was probably the best thing I did. And like, I was lucky enough while I was there as well, like, to have a particular mentor who was Claudia Bianchi, who worked there for many, many years. And she was the person I spoke to who I got the shift through. And working with her, and we're still great friends. So it's, you know, I've made friends for life. And it really sent me in an amazing direction. But yeah, you were, in some ways you're oblivious to it when you're in it. But when I left and have gone on to other things and have seen bird shows in other parts of the world now and worked on other shows, it kind of puts it in perspective what a special place that particular department is. Even just the setting. There's not many places around the world where you fly birds that close to an enormous body of water, that high up above sea level. And it's actually quite a difficult environment in a lot of senses as well, because straight away, if the bird flies 5 metres that way, they're 20 metres above the ground. And so you've got to have an extra understanding of how to train birds to deal with height and complexity in their environment to work in that space. And so learning from those trainers as a starting point was, I think, the best thing for me and set me up to succeed for the rest of my career, really. And I still think very fondly of that show. It's an amazing way for people to connect with bird life, I think.
So you're pretty young, 18, 19.
Yeah.
Wise beyond your years, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. Do you think if you hadn't got that role in that place, you'd be doing the same thing now? Like, was that a catalyst for continuing training?
I think it was because when you're for those zoo professionals out there who are listening, and for those of you who aren't zoo professionals, when you're in the environment and you're trying to get the job, you don't quite focus on what department you're heading towards. First of all, if you got casual work at the bird show, you took the casual work at the bird show, because if you want it bad enough, you just kind of take work where you can get it to start with. On the understanding that a lot of people want to work in the zoo industry. It's not an easy industry to get into by any means. And so to be able to get that work, I jumped straight in on it. And it happened to be at Bird Show, and it sparked this love, which I already kind of had. I already loved birds. But it certainly shot me in the trajectory of working with behaviour for the rest of, you know, my career so far, and set me up with a lot of great connections and experiences. So would I be working in behaviour? I probably would be working in behaviour. Would I have had the amount of experiences that I've had? And I've been very fortunate to have worked with some incredible trainers and in great places. And I'm not even 30 yet, so I'm very lucky. And I don't think I would have had those experiences if it wasn't for that Taronga Bird Show experience to start with. That really set me up in the right direction. So I'm incredibly grateful to the team there for having me.
Yeah, it's a contrast to a story we get often on the show, which is I started off with more traditional methods of animal training, but you were kind of just shoved into such a powerful mix of, like we've already mentioned, highly skilled and professional animal trainers. So fill us in on the intervening time between then and your current role. I heard you ended up working with some pretty amazing people shortly after that in Cairns.
I did. There was a particular person there who's gone on to a very successful animal training academy career. Starting off in Sydney, and you're right, I did. I kind of got my first actual experience with training was straight in with like birds and taxa that people don't historically work with in big volumes. So I'm straight in on birds, and then the work was starting to slow down at Taronga, and so I started sending my resume out and about around the place, And I was very fortunate enough to get a call for an interview from Cairns Tropical Zoo, which was a beautiful property. And I'd always loved Cairns. My family had a place there, so I used to travel there quite a lot. And I'd visited the zoo for the first time 6 months before I actually got the interview. And so I jumped on the opportunity to do the interview and then happened to get a role there. And with within the first day, I'd met Ryan, who I'm now talking to. So for those listeners out there, I met Ryan for the first time when I was 19, and I probably was a bit too confident coming into the place. But I got to work with Ryan. On my first day, I remember having lunch with Ryan and Alex Mitchell, who now works at Zoos Victoria, is a manager at Zoos Victoria. And just nerding out on behaviour and bird shows and bird show possibilities within the first day, and I was like, "This is a cool place. I'm going to love working here." And so, what followed was 3 years at Cairns Tropical Zoo. I ended up in the position of leader of bird training, so I was basically supervising the day-to-day operations of the bird show and working with a team. At the time when I left, we had 3 people on the team. As well as me and just an incredible group of birds. During that time, I was also incredibly fortunate that when I took the role in Cairns, they, because I already had an opportunity lined up, they allowed me to have a few months leave without pay to go over to the United States. So I moved to Cairns, and about 2 months after I moved to Cairns, I got on a plane and went to the USA for 3 months. And I spent a 3-month internship with Natural Encounters over in the USA, and in particular, I was working on the Birds of the World show in Texas at the Texas State Fair, which had wasn't happening actually for the last few years, but this year, very excitingly for the bird training community, the Birds of the World show has started back up again. Natural Encounters are back at the fair, and so there's some amazing videos coming out, and that experience was just incredible, working with the trainers from there. But there were lots of other international interns. So I was working with people from Portugal, France, you know, experienced bird trainers from around the world. And again, I turned 20 while I was over there. So what an experience for me to be around those people and to just absorb their knowledge. And in that one apartment complex, I remember there was one weekend in that one apartment complex was Miguel Santos, who's now the head of behaviour in a big zoo organisation in the United Arab Emirates, Wouter Stellard, Steve Martin, Ariana Bailey, who I believe you've spoken to on the podcast as well, Susan Friedman, Robbie Buells, who's an amazing trainer who works for Steve, and this whole group. There was about 22 of us, but we were sitting up till like 2-3 in the morning talking behaviour with Susan Friedman and Steve Martin over pizza and beers. And it was, you know, for a young behavior nerd, that was just like, this is cool. This is where I want to be. And within that group, we had trainers who'd come from a reptile background. So there was 2 trainers on that team who'd spent most of their prior career working with crocodilians and lizards, training animals like that. And that kind of blew my mind. I'd never heard of that happening before. I mean, we still think of that as kind of the brave new world of animal training in the zoo industry in a lot of ways, but this was, you know, almost a decade ago. And so it was really a new frontier, even a lot of ways giving enrichment to birds of prey. And things that we kind of take for granted these days were still new concepts. So getting to work with that team was unbelievable. And it was, you know, behaviours like flying Harris hawks out of ferris wheels and marabou stalks and hornbills and just bird nerd dream. Was a really interesting experience though, because I was living in North Queensland at the time working with Ryan, and I travelled to Dallas, Texas, and that was the first place I saw a palm cockatoo, which when you live in North Queensland, you're not that far from their natural habitat, but the first one I ever saw was in Dallas, Texas. So I was there, went back to Cairns, had a great time in Cairns. Again, an amazing team of people. Was lucky enough during that time as well. They supported me in travelling to a conference 2 years later in Minnesota, where I presented on labels and working around labels in a zoo environment. And so I was supported to do that, which was pretty incredible. Again, getting to see lots of different facets of the US. And then I took a weird left turn in my behavior journey, and I took a role, which I was lucky enough to be successful in getting back at Taronga Zoo. So I traveled back to Sydney, but on marine mammals. So I'd always been fascinated by seals and sea lions, and probably before the bird show as a kid, the one place I'd drag my parents every time we went to the zoo was to see the seal show. It was just a standard part of the visit. And so I got the opportunity to work with that team in 2012. So I moved back to Sydney, started working with pinnipeds, so seals, fur seals, sea lions. And that was my first really solid experience working with the closest thing to a dog that I'd ever worked with. A lot of the people who worked at marine mammals also would do puppy school training, like run puppy schools. One of them, who was an amazing trainer by the name of Ryan Tate, who was one of my supervisors, now runs a very successful dog training business in New South Wales. So I diverted to mammals relatively late in the piece, and I loved that experience. That was very different. I missed the birds, though. So I was lucky that we also had penguins. We had 50 to 60 little penguins, plus Fiordland crested penguins and Australian pelicans, all of which had behaviours that they were trained to do. Pelicans used to appear in the seal shows. But also getting to work with mammals in a different way, with, you know, a California sea lion that's 200 plus kilos, you really have to have an animal that's choosing to want to go with you, because you can't, unlike a bird that sits on your glove or sits on your hand, that animal's choosing to walk next to you or choosing to follow you. And that level of work was very new to me, and I really loved that experience. That was incredible. I had a hankering, though, to get back with birds, and particularly free flight. I think free flight, once you do it, you just get hooked into this concept of working with animals in a space where they can truly choose to leave at any point. So they're really choosing to come back and spend time with you, which is, I just don't think you can get enough of that feeling once you've done it. And I was lucky enough then to get a job in Adelaide working with Nicholas Bishop, who you mentioned earlier, who's an amazing person who I'd known off through the industry for a long time. Never had actually met him until about 6 months before I moved to Adelaide. But we'd worked on a lot of the same shows and in a lot of the same places, and lucky enough to then get to work for him as my manager, and then with a whole bunch of other amazing people in Adelaide. And Adelaide's been an amazing move for me. I really love living here, and Zoos SA is an amazing organisation. So it's been an interesting path to along the way, mostly focused with birds, bits of reptile experience up in Cairns as well, because it was a small zoo. We got to do a bit of everything, which was nice. And then, you know, a few years working with fur seals and sea lions. And you put that all together, and I'm still learning, and I've still got a lot of growth left to do as a trainer and an animal professional. But it's certainly been an incredible journey so far, and I'm very grateful for it.
Jed, you're nearly 30. I'm sorry to tell you, but it's all downhill from here. No, I'm just kidding. you jammed a lot in there, and I dare say that when you met me in Cairns, I might have been a little bit arrogant as well. But anyway, that was a long time ago. You mentioned some names there that have been on.
You were.
So Valdis Dillard's been on the show. Susan Friedman's obviously been on the show. Ryan Tate's been on the show, and some names. Ariana Bailey, as you said, some names there hopefully in future episodes as well. So what a great collection of people. And I think when I was in Dallas, that was the first time that I'd ever worked with a Kia in a show setting. So yeah. Apparently you go to Dallas if you want to work with your native species, yeah, no matter exactly. Where you are in the world.
Exactly.
And flying those Harris Hawks out of that fair as well down onto stage is something else. So Chad, you're now the senior keeper of birds and herpetofauna. Now there's a lot of dog people and horse people listening to this show going, herp to what?
Yeah. Yes.
can you explain to everyone how animal training positive reinforcement fits into your current role?
I certainly can. The birds, I've got an obvious background in training birds, although now the majority of my collection is not in shows or presentations. They're aviary exhibit animals, which we're working with mainly husbandry behaviours. And then herpetofauna is the word used to describe terrestrial ectothermic vertebrates. So that's amphibians and reptiles, basically. And so I look after the reptile house and the bird collection and a team, an incredibly talented and passionate team of 10 people. They, working across that department, there's been a big shift in the zoo industry in the last few years to expand behaviour outside of the show departments, which show departments have been running in the zoo industry since the 70s, and behaviour's been it's been at the forefront of that sort of work in seal shows and dolphin shows and bird shows. But it's only really recently started moving out into the wider exhibiting realm of the zoo industry, particularly in Australia. America have been doing some amazing stuff for years and years and years, but it's really starting to become more common here in Oz. And so that's kind of what I'm working on. It's working with exhibit animals on husbandry-based behaviours that are behaviours that we can use to better look after our animals, reduce the stress when working with them so that we can set them up to succeed for things like a conservation breeding program, even just impromptu animal encounters around the zoo rather than a structured show, and all their veterinary preventative medicine, which in a lot of ways it's much better to get animals to have a preventative medicine program based in positive reinforcement training rather than they get sick and when you have to dart and anaesthetise a cassowary, for example. If you can get that cassowary to come towards you, stand next to the fence, spend time calmly standing there, you can really look at that animal and be preventative in healthcare and husbandry rather than responsive. And so that's my main focus on behaviour in my current role. It's working at how behaviour looks in a husbandry setting rather than in a structured show setting per se.
Wonderful. And thanks for sharing all of that, Chad, so far. We call this part of the show People's Behavioural Odysseys, and
yes.
I really enjoyed it. I've been present for some of that journey, but I really enjoyed filling in some of the gaps that I learned about today. And then building on this idea of better looking after our animals, I know you've got some special stories for today's Christmas episode. We're calling it Crishel's Christmas Critter Chats. we shoved as many season there as we could. We'll see how many we get through with the time we have. But maybe one you mentioned to me when we caught up last week, and on this theme of your current role and better looking after our animals, you shared a story about getting, was it a voluntary blood draw from one of your land tortoises?
It was, yes. We've got a giant tortoise who lives with us here at Zoo South Australia. Her name's Ionica. She's 42 years old. So still a spring chicken for giant tortoise terms. But she's an Aldabra giant tortoise, so the second largest species of land tortoise in the world. And she's had some checkered health history as she's getting older. And one of the things we wanted to be able to do was get blood from her without stress. We had a moment earlier in the year where she wasn't eating as much food and she seemed just a little bit more lethargic than normal. I understand the concept of identifying lethargy in a giant tortoise might seem a little bit hard for people to grasp, but there's fast for a tortoise, and she was certainly a bit more lethargic than normal. We wanted to be able to get bloods, but to do that at the time, it was quite an invasive process, and the stress of doing that with an animal that's 120 kilos kind of outweighs the benefit of getting the blood in a lot of ways. And so what we decided to do was work towards a blood draw. And it's not something that's new in tortoises. A lot of people in the Northern Hemisphere have been doing it. But utilizing, they find this particular position really reinforcing. And we know that because it maintains and it increases in response to the stimuli. So we're not just going, every giant tortoise is reinforced by this particular stimuli. We see it in Ionica. but it's a position that they hold called finching. And where they live on these islands, one of the only ways that they can get parasites off their body is by allowing birds. So in the Galapagos, it's finches. In the Aldabra, it's rails, so a small kind of ground-dwelling bird. And they feel the birds start pecking at their legs and around their body, and they stand up. And what they do is they stretch their legs out, they stretch their neck out, and they allow the birds to get into all those places and pull the parasites out. But it's quite a vulnerable position for them, because all their sensitive areas, so their neck, their legs, their cloaca, are all exposed when they do that. But that position is quite strong. And so what we did, utilising that baseline of ethology, so going, we know that giant tortoises do this in the wild. So if you touch her very lightly behind the back of the legs or the neck, she presents with that position. Now, if you just do that and shoved a needle in her neck, you're not going to get the response you want. She'll break the finching straight away, retract her head back into her shell, and you're not going to get the blood, and it's not going to be a positive experience. So although the position's pretty strong, and it's more of a classical conditioning response rather than an operant conditioning response. It's an immediate sort of subconscious response to stimuli rather than the animal necessarily making a choice to enter that position. But what we wanted her to do was then to make a choice to keep her neck stretched out while we inserted a butterfly needle in to get blood. So that process started with starting the finching, providing that tactile, and then stopping the tactile, and then putting pressure, small amount of pressure on her neck with a whiteboard marker, a very small amount. And then after she held that in the position, and in fact, ideally, if you're holding that marker there and she stretched her neck out even a slight bit further, rather than just holding it there but extending the neck out even more, we then pull away the pen and restart the tactile. And so rather than just consistently holding the tactile there and relying on that inherent response, we also wanted her to make that choice to go, no, I'm extending this neck out further, or I'm gonna hold it here despite the fact that that tactile's since been removed, and then use the restart of that tactile experience as the reinforcer for the behaviour. Now, the only way we knew that would be reinforcing, obviously, and for all the behaviour nerds out there listening, you'd know that it's really up to the animal as to what's reinforcing and what's not reinforcing, and that each animal's slightly different, and it's only reinforcing if the behaviour maintains or increases. And what we saw with her was the whiteboard marker. She'd hold there for minutes with the whiteboard marker with a decent amount of pressure on her neck and maintained that behaviour. So we knew we were onto something. So we scaled that marker down from the whiteboard marker down to a pen, like a ballpoint pen. So she got used to more of a sharp sensation in a smaller area. And then we tried with a needle. Now, the first time we used the needle, we didn't end up getting blood. The vets weren't able to get the vein. In a tortoise, when you've got kind of saggy, wrinkly, scaly skin, it can be quite difficult to get the vein in the right spot. But she sat through the needle being inserted into her neck three times in the first session without retracting once. And when we pulled the needle out and we said, well, that's enough for today, she actually re-entered the finching position without the tactile to start with and stretched her neck out again. And so we went, fantastic, went back in there, reinforced it with the tactile, kept that position going. And we're onto something. We felt like we're onto something. And then the following fortnight, we tried again, and we got an amazing blood sample. We managed to do that with a 42-year-old giant tortoise for the first time, and that was a really gratifying experience. It was something that many people would tell you, and some people still will tell you, that you can't train a reptile. But we saw in that moment that animal chose to be involved in that process, very calmly sat in that position, and we were able to get the blood that we needed. And it was really a cool experience for me to be a part of, and for me a great achievement for that animal. That animal's now making a choice to take part in their healthcare in a way which reduces stress all round for her and for us and for the vet staff. And it's just a wonderful thing to be a part of. What was also interesting in that experience for me was utilising tactile as a reinforcer. It was something which I'd never really used before or seen used to any great success in the bird world. I understand that in other elements of animal training it's used more commonly, but in the bird world it's something that you don't tend to use as much. There's one example of an animal that I know really liked tactile, and that was an animal that worked with Ryan back at Cairns Tropical Zoo, who used to spend, Reg the Wedge-tailed Eagle, who used to spend a large amount of time with Ryan, and Ryan did an amazing job with that bird. We also had another wedge-tailed eagle there called Murray, who just absolutely loved to cuddle. But in the routines for the shows and their behavioural routines, we weren't really using that tactile to get behaviour out on stage. We were using it out the back to kind of manage them, but it was a really nice experience to do a whole behaviour start to finish with a different sort of reinforcer that I'd never used before, and I really enjoyed that too.
Yeah, amazing. Lots of amazing things about that story of the species. You said it kind of outweighs positive reinforcement. The 120 kilogram animal of doing a strain is everyone can imagine.
I did that without realizing it.
I thought it was very clever at the time. I'm reevaluating. as you can imagine, of 120 kilograms, if you make a mistake and something goes wrong, then there's definitely potential for someone to get hurt.
Yes.
Whether it's the animal or the human.
Exactly.
And lovely to have this this venue to share these types of stories. If anyone does hear that you can't train reptiles, they might look like aliens, these giant tortoises, but they are earthlings, so they do respond to behaviour the same way as Chad beautifully articulated for us. Now, Chad, I was excited the other day to jump on Instagram and see a photo of a young galah that both you and I had the pleasure of working with.
Yes.
If you ask the bird, they might tell you that their name was Jib Jib.
Yes.
We used to call the bird Jibba. And did you have some stories to share with us about Jibba today?
Oh, Jibba, what a bird. What a cracker of a bird. One of the reasons I love that bird so much is because when I arrived in Cairns, that was the first kind of project I was given to work on. And so Jibba was the first bird that I'd really had a behaviour that I worked with start to finish and worked with in a show context. Jibba, though, was already free flight trained. So Jibba was outside already and was already very comfortable around people. And so I was just kind of shaping a new routine. I was trialing the behaviour I wanted to get with Jibba was a looping flight, a big looping flight. And one of the ways I'd heard, and not by anyone who worked at Taronga or with Cairns at the time, but one of the ways I'd heard of training that was fly the bird from you to another trainer, extend the trainer out, and then eventually make that other trainer disappear. But essentially the bird goes out, can't find the trainer, and loops back around, which it's in some way, yeah, it might work pretty quickly, but it in some ways is tricking that animal as well, because you get around the corner and all that person's gone and you get this behaviour to come back. And I didn't feel inherently comfortable with that concept. And so we worked where we flew in Cairns. There was a big lake next to the show area. And describing this to the listeners, Ryan obviously knows this, but we had this big lake next to the stage and there was a wedding chapel over behind the lake, but around the lake were these trees. And so you could then utilise those trees as criteria. So if you flew around this tree, you would get this many sunflower seeds. If you flew around this tree, you would get nothing. You didn't meet criteria. But to start the behaviour, it was small little loops around building that behaviour and then getting this extended loop, essentially. What was really interesting with Jibba taught me very fast that to do anything like that, you've got to keep in mind that for the animal, you've got to keep it reinforcing. And we had another bird in that show called Candy, who was a Major Mitchell cockatoo. And Candy used to fly around to these four little perches above people's heads in the seats. And there was preloaded sunflower seeds on those perches above everyone's heads that Candy would fly down and get. Jibba one day was doing these big loops out over this lake and made a wrong turn and ended up landing on one of those perches and inadvertently found this enormous well of sunflower seeds just sitting there doing nothing. And so the entire behaviour broke down over the course of a week because Jibba found another opportunity for reinforcement that was much less energy usage on her part, got a much bigger reinforcement, a very instantaneous reinforcement. So why would you not? And it was a really interesting lesson for me as a young trainer in if you're then going, okay, well, I would like this bird to go out and do this loop. In spite of those sunflower seeds on those perches, you really have to weight the reinforcement heavily down where you want that bird to go rather than try and hide the reinforcement, block their access to the other reinforcement to start with. If you can, try and find a reinforcement that outweighs that. I wasn't able to do that. We ended up scrapping that routine and we trained a new one. We trained a gold coin routine similar to the ones utilised in Natural Encounters Inc. and at the Taronga Zoo Bird Show where the galah flies out, gets a coin, brings it back, puts it in the pocket. But a wonderful little teacher. The other thing that I learned with Jibba was utilising bridges and how effective bridges were and also how ineffective they were sometimes if I wasn't using them properly. So with Jibba, we decided because one of the concepts I had was if I wanted to train a high loop, could I train the bird to loop until it heard a whistle and then it came back down? So I had a coach's whistle rather than a seal training whistle at the time and would bridge the bird as it was rounding the corner coming back towards me. And the concept was that that response would get that bird to turn as soon as it heard the bridge, so a terminal bridge, ending the behaviour, bringing that animal back to me. And I, in that moment, what really was the bridge was the physical presence of the trainer and the presentation of the sunflower seed. That the when you actually looked at that behaviour, the whistle wasn't doing anything. And that was entirely me as a trainer not pairing that with enough reinforcement with the whistle. But also that's an okay thing because if that animal said to you, well, I'm finding this reinforcing, I'm finding flying to you reinforcing, the presentation of the food is the bridge. If that doesn't get in the way of the development of behaviour, that's not a bad thing. And it was a really good lesson as well to me in working with the animal. What's the animal actually telling you works best for that animal? And really then you're setting that animal up to succeed if you're going with what that animal is kind of itself finding, reinforcing and also the way that that animal gets information. If that animal is finding the presence of the trainer more informative than the whistle, then make that bridge be the presence of the trainer. But, yeah, love that little bird. And just a great little bird to start off with, a great little environment and a really good teacher. I enjoyed that time immensely.
The whistle wasn't doing anything. The bridge, the clicker wasn't doing anything. I think we've all been there yep. at one point. Yep. But definitely a nice learning opportunity when you can watch your videos back or have someone else observe your training or just realise it in your own training that there's other things going on that might not necessarily be what you think is going on. So a story there I feel like lots of people can relate to. So thank you so much for the two Critters Christmas Critter Chats so far. We've had a herpetofauna one, a galah parrot, a cockatoo. You said you had some mammal stories to share with us as well. Maybe one of your ones from your time with the marine mammals.
Yeah. Marine mammals are fun. They're really good fun. And it pushed me into an area of training where I had limited experience at the time. And that was, 30 to 40 cues for one animal for all these different behaviours. And it was a big learning curve for me. I was very lucky in that the team there were great teachers. I spoke about Ryan Tate. Ryan Tate was a great teacher, an amazing trainer. Brad McKenzie, another amazing trainer who still works there. And the whole team there, it was an amazing place to, again, learn from. Similar to the Taronga Zoo Bird Show, it's a real hub of knowledge and an amazing place to learn and just kind of soak up information. I was allocated to learn a furseal by the name of Mav. Mav was a New Zealand furseal, otherwise known as a long-nosed furseal here in Australia, because we're trying to highlight that those furseals are actually native to Australia as well as New Zealand. They're not just native to New Zealand, and they're an important part of our ecosystem, in particularly in South Australia, actually. I can drive down about an hour south and I can see big groups of New Zealand furseals, which makes me very happy. But Mav was the first seal I ever met as a 16-year-old youth volunteer. I have a photo with him. He was much younger. But then I got to work with him as an adult, and I got to work with him and his primary trainer, Ange Michalecki. And working with Mav was a real lesson in reinforcement. And a real lesson in the concept that behavior's never done. You never train a behavior and go, oh no, that one's finished now. I don't have to think about that behavior. I don't have to watch that behavior anymore. You still have to watch it. Mav was an amazing seal, very flexible. The generalization on his behaviors, you could take that animal pretty well anywhere and ask for a behavior that he'd do on stage, and he would do it in whatever environment he was in. The generalization in those animals was incredible. By that concept, if someone doesn't know what I mean, it means a behavior that you learn in one spot, you generalize it by moving that behavior and being able to show that same behavior with the same cue in a different location, in a different environment. So that animal had great generalization skills. The one thing that he was so good at, though, was he was really good at the basic behaviors, to the point where, as a young trainer newly working with first seals, I went, he sits on the box really well. And when we're doing a show, they sit on a box facing the audience, and then they would do all their different behaviors on the box. So he sits on the box really well. I don't necessarily need to reinforce that as much as the other behaviors. And I wasn't probably paying enough attention to that particular behavior. I'd watch him in all these other behaviors, but in those moments I was like looking at the audience, and I was spending more of my time chatting to the crowd. And I was missing little things from him, like he might have been looking over his shoulder and looking backstage, or what's going on with the crowd over there, or he'd react to the noise from a seal out the back. And this culminated one day with me on stage in front of 1,000 people doing a show, and in the middle of it, he just walked off. And it's a really humbling experience when you stand there and you've got a microphone on and you're trying to do a show, and the seal just goes and disappears. Just nuff, bye, off they go. Now, I don't know what he was saying in his mind. Obviously, I can't. I'm not inside the animal's mind. But he chose at that moment that walking off stage and going back into his holding pool out the back was more reinforcing to him at that moment than sitting on the box next to me. Now, that was an eye-opener for me. I was like, wow, I was taking that behavior so for granted. And it was a really great lesson to me. Behavior's never done. You never have a behavior that you work on for years and years and years, or someone else has worked on, which it was with Matt. Someone else had trained him all these behaviors. I was just learning how to work him and those behaviors in that context. Someone's worked on that for years, but it doesn't mean that it's finished. You've still got to watch it and make sure that that behavior is meeting criteria and is being reinforced enough. And the way, of course, we know that is if it maintains or increases, and it didn't maintain that. It just in that moment, that was more reinforcing to him, that pull out the back. And from that moment, working with Ryan Tate, who actually saw that particular show, great trainer, he was like, well, we've got to increase the amount of reinforcement we have available. So we were portioning the fish, so we're cutting up the fish, so I had lots and lots of reinforcement available to keep streams of reinforcement high to those sorts of stationary behaviours. And it was at that moment I meant to work on this behaviour. And it was a really great lesson in, okay, this animal's got 30 behaviors. What at this moment requires the most reinforcement? And it's that give and take and that constant balance of behavior, because behavior doesn't exist in a vacuum. Behavior is constantly in interacting with environment. And so different antecedents will change a behavior that animal yesterday might have been completely fine with, but today something's changed and that animal chooses to respond to a similar stimuli in a different way. And so that was a really good lesson for me in that sense. But the other reason I loved fur seals and sea lions was using behaviour for research. I understand there's some ethical dilemmas that people have with marine mammals, particularly in human care and animals being in a zoo environment. But in the time I was at Taronga, the animals in that collection there were taking part in a multitude of research projects. So we were using behaviour, free choice behaviours. So it was, swim between these targets, and if they didn't want to, they didn't have to. But some of the sea lions were even trained to swim laps back and forward underwater and then pop their head up in a dome that was measuring what they were breathing out. So scientists were able to actually attach little accelerometer devices that were measuring movement and then could measure how much of an impact that had on the animal's energy output. So was this slowing this animal down? Was it affecting its behaviour in any way by this animal popping its head up in this little plexiglass dome so you could measure what it was breathing out? So you could actually get this animal's metabolic rate, essentially. And then that information was used as an ethics approval for those devices to be put on wild fur seals. And the information that you gather in that environment is just crucial to understanding these animals in the wild and being able to ask that animal in your care to lie down so you can install this accelerometer device onto its back, then to stand up and then do these behaviours on cue so you can actually get a control and an understanding of what you're seeing and in your data. It just changes the game for research, and it's a really tangible way that animals in human care are helping animals in the wild and conservation as a whole. And the behaviour element of that I really loved. It's a great thing to see. Even they were utilising these devices to measure feeding patterns. An accelerometer is essentially the same device in your iPhone that when you turn it one way, it measures, it senses the directional change, and so it changes the screen. And an accelerometer is basically that. But this would sense movement up and down and in three dimensions in the water column and speed. So with that, what they would do is they could give our sea lions, for example, an octopus, an enormous octopus that we've got from the fish markets, with the device on, and then they would watch our sea lion eat this octopus with the device on, and then looking at the data from that device, they can then go, okay, that's what the pattern looks like when they're eating an octopus. And then we'd give them a fish, and then you could see that's what it looks like when they're chasing a school of fish, or when they're swimming really fast, or when they're porpoising, or when they're relaxing on a beach. And you could see all that in the data. So you can then put that on a wild seal, not see it for 6 months, but take that data away from it and get a complete picture of what that animal's been up to, which is just mind-blowing. And also, we at the time had the only leopard seal that was in human care in the whole world. His name was Casey. He had washed up in Sydney Harbour, just south of Sydney, and as an animal that was very lost from Antarctica, was very unwell and so was unreleasable. So we had this leopard seal, which an incredible privilege to work with. And one of the things that they were looking at with leopard seals in human care at Taronga was their dietary makeup, because you can actually find out what they've been eating by measuring their whiskers. You can get chemicals from their whiskers and it tells you the food that they've been eating. So what that means is we found all those signatures in human care. So a scientist can now go out into the wild, into the field, get a small sample of whisker, and can find out what that animal's been eating over the course of its life, which if that doesn't tell you something about ecology and the environment, I don't know what does. So it's the applications of positive reinforcement training in the zoo environment and also in the outside of the zoo environment have amazing opportunities for learning about animals and supporting their conservation as well. So, yeah, working with fur seals and sea lions was a really big learning experience for me and very valuable one.
And obviously named New Zealand fur seals because of their incredibly good looks and high intelligent levels as well.
Exactly. And,
somewhere on my computer I have a video of you doing one of these shows at Taronga Zoo. I came in as a guest once and took some videos for my own personal use. And I love what that show does and what other professional animal shows around the world do so well is the subtleness of the cues that you're giving the animals. It looks like they're kind of responding to what you're saying, and something that you were very good at that time. And I admire and kind of think about when I teach others about how to do this in show settings, you are the person that comes into my mind as I remember watching your very subtle cues. And it must have been with Mav, I'm assuming.
I feel like it would have been Mavi.
I have a problem, Chad, and that is that you're too good at passion talking. Looking at the time, we had 5 Criddles Christmas Critter Chats today. We can squeeze one more in, I think. If we do any more than that, we're going to be running out of time. As much as you can, continue to passion talk and keep it short, do that. But you had a few more examples, and maybe you had one with a domestic animal that you're going to share with us, and how you've used what you've learned in the zoo environment and working with herpetofauna and working with birds and working with marine mammals, and how you brought this into your home with some of your dogs.
Yeah, for sure. So I've got 2 beautiful dogs, and I started working and training dogs very late in the piece. It was one of the last animals I actually kind of set in my mind, I'm going to train a behavior with this critter start to finish. So sort of opposite to a lot of the way that people enter the behavior industry. But we've got 2 rescue dogs. One of them is a beautiful Lassie breed dog, so a Scotch Collie. His name's Marshall. And he was 18 months old and entire. He wasn't a sex when we got him. And he'd had 0 work done when he was a puppy. They hadn't done any behavior with him at all, any socialization with other dogs. He hardly went for walks when he was a youngster. And so we had a challenge on our hands with this animal. He's so lovely. He's such a lovely dog. But his response to the environment, because everything around him was new and interesting because he hadn't experienced it before, he just wanted to check everything out. But what that would translate to was he'd just run and just keep going to the next stimuli. He wouldn't ever stop and go, oh, where's Chad? So on a walk, this was really, really difficult. And he had 0 recall that had been worked with him in the past. And so I had to kind of start from scratch with this animal. And it was a really good lesson for me in setting up the environment to succeed. So for him, other dogs, because he wasn't socialized very much as a puppy, excitement central. He just wants to, and I say this because what I interpret his behavior as is he wants to be with these other dogs. He'll break from anything if he sees a dog, tail wagging, and he goes up and he says hi, and he just loves being around other dogs. And he'll run hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of meters if I would have let him to get to another dog, despite me, you know, running behind him. He's far too focused on that other stimuli. So I found an environment which not many other people took their dogs to. You very rarely saw dogs. If they had dogs coming, you could see them a K away because it's this big kind of open paddock. And so there we had this environment where it was much easier for me to work with the stimuli because I could see it coming. I could manage the environment a little bit easier rather than in the traditional dog park sense where there's so many animals around, it's really hard to control those stimuli in the same way. So we'd go out into the field. And one of the things I learned with birds was if they fly off, if they divert from their routine, there's no point calling them, cueing them to fly to you if they're not looking at you or if they're not actually focused on you at that moment. If they're looking over their shoulder or eating food or have all their feathers slipped down to their body because they've seen a predator around, they're not going to fly down to your hand at that moment. They're not going to come back to you. So in some ways, the continued delivery of the cue in those moments is wasting the power of that cue. Because it's a cue that's delivered, the behavior doesn't take place and the animal gets no reinforcement in the place of that in response to that cue. So you're losing the power of that cue in essence. And so I tried to translate that into Marshall's behavior, which was he'd run in this paddock, and there was nothing else around. So I knew that he wasn't going to run off too far. But he'd run sometimes at the start of this process, like 100 meters away. And I would just stand still. The moment he turned his head and looked at me, and it could sometimes take a good 10 minutes before he would, but the moment he did, it was, yay, good boy, straight away, get all excited, and he'd run back to me straight away. And then at the time it seemed he was so excited by the stimuli of a park that even he wouldn't necessarily eat food. So treats were a challenge, but I found a particular treat that he loved. And that to me was shown by the fact that he would eat that treat in many different environments. So that particular animal then was, you know, he'd go and go and go. But the minute he looked back, epic, well done, come back, get time, play time, pats, lots of treats, fantastic. And over time, that behavior got stronger because he'd go, oh, yeah, this is exciting. Oh, but the moment I look around, I get all this cool stuff. And that was showing to me by the distance that he'd walk away from me before he'd turn and the time amount before he'd turn around and look at me. And at the moment he turned around and start running back, I would then say his name. So I would then go, Marshall, after he'd already committed to running back to me. Now we're at a point where we can go to the park and he can be 100 metres away from me looking in the opposite direction and I can say, Marshall, and he'll stop what he's doing and he'll run back. We're still not to the point where I could run him past a group of dogs. He would still break. So we're still working on it. But that was a really great example to me, a learning opportunity for me. What's the environment doing, but also what's the animal telling you? The animal's not looking at you. Don't waste a cue by yelling the name 30 times and not being able to give that animal an opportunity to receive reinforcement. Wait for that animal to say, oh, no, I'm paying attention to you, and almost take that first step back towards you themselves and then pile on the reinforcers. And that has shown to work with him. It's still a work in progress, but it's been a great learning experience, taking that zoo-based knowledge and transferring it to an animal that I live with at home. In saying that, you've met my dogs, Ryan. A lot of basic stuff around the house, it kind of it goes without serious training programs because I work with behavior all day. And so when I get home, the dogs don't really have, you know, stations around the house or anything, and they can just pile on the couch and what have you. But that's fine. That makes me happy, makes them happy from what I can tell in their behavior. So, but we work on the stuff out in the field and I'm enjoying that a lot.
I was worried, but you did well. Reining it in. And I like that true bit of what I'm going to call Australiana in there, where you said the moment Marshall looked at you, epic. Well done. But as you said, behaviour is never finished. So a nice sum up of how you've utilised your experience and knowledge in teachings from tortoises and galahs and New Zealand fur seals to work with Marshall and some of his behaviours. Chad, we are sadly at the end. And in this part of the show, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts. And we ask this to everyone that comes on the show. What do you really want to see happen moving forward? You've taken us back to where you got started. You've filled in the gaps in between, shared some amazing Critters Christmas Critter Chats with us today. What do you really want to see moving forward? What do you want to see in the positive reinforcement animal training world, domestic, zoo-based, and every other place we care for and look after animals over the next 5 to 10 years?
I would love to see positive reinforcement animal training being just the accepted standard way that you work with all animals in any venue around the world. In some fields, like I was talking about reptiles, for example, we're still having to communicate the benefits of positive reinforcement training rather than it just being the accepted standard practice. In 5 to 10 years' time, I'd be a very happy man if it was just the standard operational style that an animal in human care had at least one voluntary husbandry behaviour and was operating on least intrusive, most positive. And that would just make me happy. Because when you look at the relationships that you form with animals when you work in that sort of environment, the results that you get, I don't think it can be beaten. I just don't see other operational styles being anywhere near as successful as positive reinforcement. And whether it's with a cockroach or a whale, or in my professional experience, whether it's a chameleon or a deer or an eagle, if you give that animal a reason to want to be with you and a reason to take part in behaviour with you, it's just a much stronger end product and an incredibly fulfilling thing to be around. So if that was all through the zoo industry and in people's homes with their pet bearded dragons and their pet rats and their pet, dogs and horses and cats and everything, I'd be a very happy person. And I think we're heading in the right direction for that. I think that the majority of people understand the reason to use positive reinforcement. It's just still got a little bit of a way to go, but that would make me very happy.
Well, Chad, I think you've still got some amazing things to do in your career. Like you said, you're nearly reached that 30 stage, so lots of who knows where you're going to be in the next 5 to 10 years. I'm excited every time I head over your way. I'm excited to catch up and see what you're up to now, and you always have some really amazing things to share with me. So just continue being awesome, you, and thanks again so much for coming and hanging out today with us at Animal Training Academy. This has been a ton of fun. We've really appreciated it. Thank you, Chad.
No, thank you very much for the opportunity to share, and I've really enjoyed it. So thank you, Ryan. It's good to catch up.
And have an amazing Christmas, everyone. We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.